You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 175 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, with a small cycle included Human Life in a Cosmic Context. The first full reading of this collected works. And it's translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is lecture 15 of 17 lectures, given in Berlin on the 24th of April, 1917. It has become clear from the previous lectures that it is important for the present, and will be even more so for the future, to realize that our understanding of Christ Jesus and of everything connected with the mystery of Golgotha cannot rely solely upon the kind of outward observation, as is characteristic, of the ordinary scientific approach to the study of history today, and that sources other than historical study, in the modern sense, need to be tapped in order to arrive at a knowledge of Christ and the mystery of Golgotha that is convincing and can be demonstrated as being true, even when these sources are the Gospels themselves. I have often stated, and anyone who makes himself familiar with the relevant literature can confirm this, that the most assiduous, diligent, and painstaking research has been devoted to critical study of the Gospels in the 19th century. And it can indeed be said that purely as an outward historical phenomenon, this Gospel criticism has yielded only negative results, which have served more to destroy and dissipate the ideas than one may have of the mystery of Golgotha than to affirm and substantiate them. We know that a large number of people today, not out of a spirit of opposition, but because they do not see what else they can do, acknowledge that from their historical research, they have arrived at the conclusion that there is no justification, on purely historical grounds, for saying that it is possible to prove that Christ Jesus actually existed at the beginning of our era. Of course, it cannot be disproved either, but that is of no particular consequence. I shall now address the question how it is possible to discover other sources for a knowledge of the mystery of Golgotha than are available from historical sources. I shall approach this question by first considering certain aspects of occult history that I have already touched upon in earlier lectures. If one studies the first centuries of the development of Christianity, with the awareness that this evolutionary journey is really only comprehensible if one intensifies a purely historical study by means of research of a spiritual scientific nature, and if therefore one initially grants at least an hypothetical validity to such a spiritual scientific study of this period, a very remarkable picture emerges. As one casts one's eye, EYE, over these early Christian centuries, one comes to the conclusion that the mystery of Golgotha did not occur only once, as an isolated occasion on Golgotha itself, but that it was in a sense replicated on a second occasion in the whole panorama of historical development. There is indeed much that is remarkable about this whole period of history. The established traditional view is that there is a history of the Catholic Church which begins with the founding of Christianity, and then proceeds from the early church fathers and teachers of the first Christian centuries to the teachers and philosophers of the following centuries, the formulation of particular dogmas by the councils and infallible popes, and so forth. History is seen as a kind of unbroken thread, which is described as though it was unfolding with the same character. Much criticism is leveled against the early church fathers, but by and large, people are afraid to reject them completely, because one would then be interrupting the ongoing process of development that links up with the Council of Constantinople in 869, of which I have already spoken. As I have said, the picture is given of a continuous historical process. But if there is a radical gap anywhere in an apparently continuous process, it is in this seemingly consistent line of historical development. If one really looks at the essence of what is going on, it would be scarcely possible to imagine a greater contrast between the spirit of the early church fathers and that of the later teachers of the Christian church and the decrees of the councils. A radical difference can be discerned here, which, because of the prevalence of certain interests, has been equally radically blurred. It has therefore been possible to maintain an ignorance amongst people today of the early Christian centuries and of what actually happened then. There is, for example, hardly any real idea, even amongst scholars, of the way that Gnosticism was eradicated. Similarly, there is a considerable lack of clarity as to the real intentions of people like Clement of Alexandria, his pupil Origen, and others, including Tertullian, because of a large part of the fragmentary information that has come down to us, consists of the writings of those who oppose them. And because of all the extraordinary theories that have been constructed on the basis of these fragments, it is well nigh impossible to arrive at a reliable picture of these early church fathers and teachers. In order to arrive at a clear understanding of these matters, we need to look more closely at the reasons for this obscurity, and specifically to what, in a certain sense, led the mystery of Golgotha to be enacted for a second time in history. When the mystery of Golgotha had taken place, ancient pagan rituals were still being practiced on a very wide scale. Their prominence was such that, as we saw from the previous lecture, a figure such as Julian the Apostate was initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries. And it was also the case that, albeit in a somewhat irregular way, a large number of Roman emperors had undergone an initiation of some sort. Furthermore, everything connected with the ancient pagan rituals still existed, although this is usually dismissed today with a few words, in a way that does not do justice to history. Everything that occurred is related in a highly superficial way. But even these superficial descriptions can be sufficient for many people to be able to speak of a second mystery of Golgotha, even though they do not have any real understanding of the real meaning of these events. If one looks at the outward phenomena, one can say that in the early centuries of the Christian era, there were pagan temples of every kind scattered over a very wide area, which had a splendor and magnificence that is barely conceivable today. And these temples had idols, which in the very details of their formation were an artistic reflection of what had lived in the old mysteries. Not only was there no town or landscape without an abundance of artistic representations of the mysteries in these far-off times, but out in the fields where the peasants grew cereals, there were little isolated shrines, each with its idol. No agricultural work was done without a living connection being established with those forces which, the peasants believed, streamed down from the universe with the help of the magic powers that which resided in these images. The Roman emperors, in conjunction with the bishops and priests, did all they could in the course of these centuries utterly to destroy all these temples and shrines with their images and idols, a process that we can follow until the reign of the Emperor Justinian in the 6th century, through a steady succession of edicts ordering their ruthless destruction. A massive wave of destruction swept over the world during these centuries that is without comparison in the whole of human evolution, especially if one bears in mind what was being destroyed. This period, when one of the most important tasks of the Roman emperors, who had formed Christianity in their own mold since the time of Constantine, was to destroy what remained from ancient times, culminated in the event when Saint Benedict, with his own hands and the support of his workmen, leveled the Temple of Apollo at Monte Cassino to the ground, in order to found a monastery dedicated to the Benedictine order, and more generally, in the time of the Emperor Justinian. There were also edicts which were seemingly intended to stop this work of destruction. However, if one reads them, one receives a curious impression. One emperor, for example, issued a decree which stated that not all the pagan temples should be destroyed at once, as that would incite the people to rebellion, and that everything should be done very gradually, so that they would allow it to happen, and not engage in insurrectionary activity. All the terrible measures associated with this destructive work are very often glossed over, like many other things. But this should not happen, for where the truth is sullied in any way, the path to Christ Jesus is also obscured and cannot be found. Some special discoveries can be made regarding this earnest love of truth, my dear friends. I should like to recount a minor incident that occurred in my own life, which I mention because I experienced it in my early childhood. One never forgets such things. Now, unless one has been thoroughly blocking one's ears, one will have heard from the history of the Roman emperors that this Constantine, of whom we have been speaking, was no model of virtue. Indeed, if he had been a person of real virtue, he would not have unjustifiably accused his own stepson of having a liaison with his own mother. The accusation was false and was fabricated in order to supply a reason for his murder. And then had his stepson murdered for this fabricated reason, followed by the stepmother. These were by no means the worst of Constantine's deeds. But since the church was very deeply indebted to him, official church history is ashamed of presenting Constantine as he really was. I should like to read you a passage about Constantine from my school textbook on the history of religion. Quote, "Constantine manifested his religious convictions also in his private life," and I have already told you how things really stood, continue quote, "although he was reproached for his domineering nature and irascibility, one needs to bear in mind that faith is no protection against every indiscretion, and that Christianity could not manifest its full sanctifying power through him, because to the end of his life he eschewed participation in the Holy Sacrament," close quote. Justifications of this kind are very widespread, and you can glean much from them about the degree to which a love of truth has been a common phenomenon in history. The situation with respect to recent history is little better. But because other interests are playing in, one does not so easily notice that the problems relate to different points of view. When these edicts are discussed, it is also mentioned that the Roman emperors were particularly opposed to blood sacrifices, or the sacrifice of animals, which are said to have been made in such temples, together with other similar practices. My intention here is neither to engage in criticism nor to gloss over anything, but simply to relate what actually occurred. The point to bear in mind is that when reference is made to opposition to animal sacrifice, from the entrails of which future events were said to have been predicted, what is being spoken of was indeed a decadent form of sacrifice. However, it was not the trivial pursuit that history often implies, but it was a profound scientific endeavor, albeit very different from the science of today. It is difficult to speak about these matters today, because they are regarded as utterly repulsive, and it is only possible to characterize them in general terms. But the object of such animal sacrifices was to stimulate something that was no longer directly available at this time, because the age of the old atavistic clairvoyance was past. It was a way, one way among others, of reviving the ancient clairvoyant powers within certain circles of the pagan priesthood. A more satisfactory method of cultivating this ancient clairvoyant power in order to penetrate to primeval times was to revive the particular form of sacrifice practiced in the Mithras mysteries, which was the most spiritual form of that time. In the priestly mysteries of Egypt and the Egyptian temples, the practices were more brutal and bloody. If one studies the Mithras mysteries with occult means, one realizes that they represented a way of gaining insight into the mysteries of the forces at work in the universe through sacrificial rites, which went beyond what one associates with sacrificial rites today. For they yielded a far deeper insight into the mysteries of nature than modern autopsies and dissection of corpses, which do not delve into secrets of any sort, but merely dabble on the surface. Anyone who had performed these sacrifices in the right way developed a certain clairvoyance for particular forces that are present in the mysteries of nature. It was for this reason that the true foundations of the ritual sacrifices were surrounded in secrecy, and that access to them was granted only to those who were adequately prepared. Now, when we study the Mithras mysteries, we find that they all go back to the third post-Atlantean epoch, and that they were, therefore, at the time in question, in a decadent phase of their development, in that, in their pure form, they were suited to the third epoch. In their most elevated phase, in the third post-Atlantean period, they represented a way of entering deeply into the mysteries of nature, parenthesis, albeit one that was enshrouded in danger and secrecy, close parenthesis, in that the rites that were performed had the power to bring this about. In the presence of the pupils, the priests performed certain rituals associated with the separating out of the elements of natural substances in order to arrive at a knowledge of the constituent parts of natural processes. Through the way in which this occurred, how, in the course of their rituals, the water present in the organisms interacted with fire, and how this interaction represented a stimulus for the one who was present at the sacrifice, a special path was opened up to the pupil, which led him to a self-knowledge that reached to the innermost fibers of his being, and hence to a knowledge of the world. Hence these sacrifices were a path leading to self-knowledge and knowledge of the world. People experienced themselves differently from their experience of themselves in ordinary life when they were present at such sacrifices. But this experience was, to a high degree, tailored to man's weakness. For self-knowledge is extremely difficult to acquire, and these sacrifices lessened the burden of acquiring it. Through these sacrifices, people were led to feel and experience themselves inwardly, though far more intensely than through mere intellectual or conceptual processes. One might say that they strove for a self-knowledge that penetrated to their bodily organism, to their physical form, a self-knowledge that can be discerned in the minds of the great artists of antiquity, who in a sense owed their sense of form to their experience of the forms and movements of nature in their own organism. For the further back we go in the history of art, the more do we arrive at a time when it would have been completely incomprehensible to create from a model, to have a model in front of one, which one proceeded to copy. We become increasingly aware that people had a living reality within themselves, which they embodied in their creations. Everything has inwardly become so inert nowadays that it hardly bears speaking about, because words are inadequate as a means of expressing what we mean by them. It is quite extraordinary how times have changed. Now, the Greek mysteries of Eleusis were a direct continuation of these mysteries which were widely disseminated at the time of the mystery of Golgotha. They represented a continuation, but also a different aspect of these mysteries. Whereas in the Mithras mysteries, there was an emphasis upon experiencing oneself through the instrument of the body, in the mysteries of Eleusis, everything revolved around experiencing oneself outwardly rather than inwardly. The rituals in the Eleusinian mysteries were quite different from those of the Mithras mysteries, where the neophyte was drawn deeply into himself, whereas in the Eleusinian mysteries he was lifted out of himself, so that he experienced the mystery-laden impulses of the creative activity of nature and the spirit outside the body. If we ask ourselves what the person derived from these mysteries, both the Mithras mysteries, which by then were decadent, and those of Eleusis, which were not decadent then, but had even been at the peak of their development a few centuries before the beginning of the Christian era, and specifically in the 4th century B.C., the answer would be couched in terms of the great injunction of the Delphic oracle, quote, "Know thyself," close quote. Everything was oriented toward around self-knowledge, and moreover, self-knowledge in two different forms. On the one hand, this occurred through the person becoming totally immersed in himself, so that the etheric and astral bodies were compressed, and he was thrust inwardly into himself, with the result that the inner impact of his soul upon his bodily nature led him to experience, quote, "You are what you perceive when you reach down inwardly into yourself and encounter what is there," close quote. This happened through the Mithras mysteries. Through the Eleusinian mysteries, on the other hand, a person arrived at self-knowledge through the soul being lifted out of the body by means of various rituals, which will not be described further here. And the person concerned entered into connection outside the body with the mysterious influences of the sun upon the earth, with the forces of the moon that irradiate it, together with the impulses of the stars and of elemental forces such as warmth, air, fire, and so forth. These external forces, this outward existence, pervaded the human soul, which was thus lifted out of the body. And through this encounter with the outer world, self-knowledge was attained. Those who understood the essential meaning of the mysteries knew that they had access to every kind of soul experience. But it was not possible for them to arrive at a real idea of the ego unless it derived directly from the mysteries. For the ego otherwise continued to be a wholly abstract phenomenon at that time. People were able to experience anything else of a soul-spiritual nature, but the ego had to be nurtured through the mysteries and required this strong external stimulus. The essential point is that this was known to be the case at this time. What came about then was, as you know, a fusion between Christianity as it was then evolving and the impulse of Rome. I have already described how this arose, and as it did so, there was a growing desire to wipe out all trace of what remained of the past, to prevent any real legacy of this world from being bequeathed to posterity, and specifically what people had been doing in the early centuries of the Christian era to form a connection, whether in or outside the body, with those divine forces that bring man his ego consciousness. If we wish to enter more deeply into a study of the development of Christianity, we will need to consider not merely the continuing development of dogmas, but most especially the development of cults and rituals. From certain points of view, the ongoing development of ritual is far more important than the history of dogma, for dogmas bring arguments. In a certain sense, they are like the phoenix bird, in that they rise again from their own ashes, and however much dogmas may have been eradicated, some crank will always come along favoring what has become outmoded. It is far easier to wipe out all trace of rituals. And the intention behind eradicating these ancient rituals, which were the outward signs, the visible external symbols of what was taking place in the mysteries, was to make it impossible for anyone to discern from the continuing existence of the rituals how people had endeavored to enter into a relationship with divine spiritual forces. In order to delve more deeply into these matters, we need to turn our attention to the Christian rituals, for example, the chief sacrament of the Mass, the Catholic Mass. What fundamentally is the inner significance of the Catholic Mass? What is it? The Mass, together with everything associated with it, is a continuing development of the Mithras mysteries, combined in a certain sense with elements from the Eleusinian mysteries. It is none other than the continuation of ancient rituals, though developed further in a certain way. Especially the bloody character that the Mithras mysteries had gradually assumed has been distinctly reduced in its intensity. However, anyone who is able to appreciate certain details can only be aware of the considerable similarity of the spirit underlying these rituals. For example, the priest, together with anyone who is receiving communion, receives the body of the Lord after he has not eaten anything for a certain while. Thus, a period of fasting is far more important for understanding what is going on here than a great deal of what people argued about so furiously in the Middle Ages. And if a priest, as may well happen, neglects to honor this commitment to perform the transubstantiation and communion after a period of fasting, the Mass does not have the significance or the effect that it should have. It does, in any case, not have the required effect for the most part, because the communicants have not been appropriately instructed. For there can only be an influence if people have been told about what is experienced immediately after receiving the bloodless body of the Lord. But you are probably aware of how little attention is paid to these details today, how little people realize that they should be having an experience that represents a certain inner residuum, a kind of modern renewal of what was imparted through the Mithras mysteries. Thus, there are great mysteries hidden behind these rituals. The Church similarly sought to establish a certain continuity of the ancient principle of initiation through ordination, except that it has largely forgotten that the principle of initiation lay in giving specific teachings as to how to understand what is being experienced. Now, Julian's avowed intention was to discover how the Eleusinian mysteries, into which he had been initiated, were related to the mysteries of the third post-Atlantean age. But what was he able to learn of this from these mysteries? History has virtually nothing to say on this point. But if you were really to engage in a study of how people such as Clement of Alexandria, his pupil Origen, Tertullian, and even Irenaeus, to say nothing of the still earlier church fathers, were themselves largely rooted in the pagan principle of initiation, and then in their own way made the transition to Christianity, if you were to glimpse into the minds of these great individuals, you would find that their ideas and concepts were imbued with a quite particular quality of inner mobility, that a completely different spirit lived in them from that which was later to dwell amongst mankind. If we want to develop a closer understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, it is really important that we gain something of an inkling of the spirit that lived in these early church fathers. The fact is that people are so very much asleep, and I mean this quite literally, with respect to the wider dimensions of culture. They view the world as if they were in dreamland. We can see this in our own time. I have often spoken to you about Hermann Grimm. I must confess that it is quite different for me now to be speaking about Hermann Grimm from when I spoke about him 4 or 5 years ago. If one is attentive to these matters, what we have now been experiencing in the 3 years of this war makes what immediately preceded it and the decades leading up to this time seem like a kind of fairy tale world, which could well be centuries ago. Things have changed to such an extent that one has the feeling that events took place longer ago than they really did. In a similar way, much that is important in the world is experienced by people in a state of sleep. If one tries to understand ancient writers with ordinary faculties of comprehension today, and of course a university professor will be able to understand everything that has been transmitted to posterity, one may, even without being a person with such an enlightened mind, arrive at the conclusion that the ancient Greek philosophers, such as Thales, Heraclitus, and Anaxagoras, who did, after all, live not so very long ago, cannot really be understood unless one is able to study them with occult means. Even if one reads them in Greek, the fact is that they speak a different language from the one that is generally available for ordinary human discourse. This even applies to Plato, for example. I have often said that Hebbel was aware of this when, in a sketch for a play that he jotted down in his diary, he had the idea of depicting the reincarnated Plato as a grammar school pupil who has to study Plato with his teacher, and who, despite having a clever teacher, is completely unable to cope with Plato, even though he is the reincarnation of him. Hebbel wanted to make a drama out of this idea. He never got round to it, but he did indeed write in his diary how it would turn out if the reincarnated Plato was a modern grammar school pupil and found that he could not understand a word of what Plato had written. Thus it was Hebbel's view that not even Plato can readily be understood. Understanding in the sense of a precise grasping of concepts is something in human intellectual life that really begins only with Aristotle. It does not go further back. It begins with Aristotle in the 4th century B.C. What preceded Aristotle cannot be understood with ordinary powers of reason. People have, therefore, been constantly trying to understand Aristotle, for on the one hand he can be understood, while on the other hand, with respect to certain of his thought forms, no further advances have been made beyond Aristotle, for the reason that his way of thinking belonged very much to his time. After all, trying to think in the way that another age has thought is essentially the same as the situation of a man of 56 who wants to be 26 years old for a quarter of an hour in order to experience what it is like to be 26. A certain way of thinking is appropriate only for a quite specific time. The particular character of thinking is constantly changing from age to age. It is, nevertheless, interesting to note that in the Middle Ages, Aristotle dominated the intellectual scene, and that he again reappears in the work of Franz Brentano, to whom I have often referred in a very recent publication. For in 1911, Franz Brentano wrote a very fine book about Aristotle, where he has elucidated those ideas that are particularly suited to our present time. It is very timely that Franz Brentano should have just now written a comprehensive book about Aristotle, which everyone who values keeping in touch with a certain quality of thinking should read. This book by Brentano about Aristotle is, moreover, very readable. It was, however, Aristotle's fate that his work was indirectly mutilated, not so much by Christianity, but by the Church, and that some important parts of his writings have been lost. Thus, what has come down to us in a mutilated form needs to be supplemented by occult means. The most important omissions relate to the human soul. And I find a certain link with respect to the challenge of responding to people today when they ask, how can I direct my meditative life, as described, for example, in the book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, in such a way that through inner soul experiences, I can find a sure path to discerning within myself the sources of the mystery of Golgotha. For Aristotle tries in his own way to bring that inner experience to life within himself, which anyone asking this question would have to replicate. But according to his commentators, whenever Aristotle is about to describe his own meditative path, he stops short and says no more. However, this apparent taciturnity does not necessarily imply that Aristotle did not write about these matters, but rather that those who came after him did not copy it, with the result that it has not come down to us. Aristotle had already opened up a quite distinctive inner, or even mystical, path. He wanted to discover that quality in the soul that endows it with the inner certainty that the soul is immortal. Now, if a person honestly and sincerely engages in inner meditative work and practices an inner discipline, he will have an inner experience of the soul's immortality through this being inwardly revealed to him. It was completely and utterly clear to Aristotle that it is inwardly possible to experience something that is independent of the body, and which therefore has nothing to do with the death of the body. This was totally clear to Aristotle. But he goes further and tries to experience with full intensity within himself that which one can experience with absolute certainty as not belonging to the body. And then he experiences with full clarity, though the relevant passage is corrupt or has been mutilated, what one must have experienced in order to come to an understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. Inner solitude. Solitude. Mystical experience inevitably leads one to such a solitude, to suffering the grief of solitude. And if this feeling of solitude has grown in intensity to the point where one asks, quote, what have I forsaken that I have become lonely? Close quote. One will be obliged to answer, quote, I have, with the best part of my being, forsaken father, mother, brothers, sisters, and the rest of the familiar world in my soul. Close quote. This was what Aristotle was aware of. This inner experience is something that one can have. It can be invoked. One is well aware in this sense of solitude that there is something within one that transcends death, but that this is not connected with anything except one's own ego. And it has no relationship to the outside world. One comes to realize what Aristotle also realized, that one's contact with the outer world is mediated through the organs of the body. There are other ways in which one can experience oneself, but one needs the organs of the body in order to experience the outer world. Hence the solitude that becomes a feature of our experience. And now Aristotle said to himself, as everyone who follows in his wake must also realize, quote, I have therefore experienced the soul. I have experienced my immortal soul, which death cannot destroy. But at the same time, everything that brings me in touch with the outside world has gone. I am confined within myself. I cannot make any further progress with understanding immortality, he said, continue quote, beyond realizing that after death I shall experience myself in utter solitude, with nothing before me for all eternity other than the good and evil deeds that I have performed. This is what I shall behold for all eternity. And it is this that lies in my power to achieve. If I want to know anything else about the spiritual world, I cannot rely on my own forces alone, but must either follow a path of initiation or listen to what the initiates can tell me. Close quote. all this was stated in Aristotle's writings, but it was not passed on by his successors. And because Aristotle perceived this, he became a kind of prophet. He became the prophet for that different quality of perception that lay beyond the possibilities of his time, and which is different today from how it was then. But there is no need to make a historical survey to discover this, for we know that it is so from personal experience. Let us consider once more this experience of total solitude which belongs to modern life, this mystical experience which is completely different from the way that mystical experiences are very often described. For they are very often described in a self-satisfied way, as if to say, quote, "I experience God within my inner being," close quote. But this is not the full mystical experience. The full mystical experience is to say that one experiences God in complete and utter solitude, that one experiences oneself alone with God. And then it is only a question of having the necessary strength and endurance to continue living in this solitude. For this experience of solitude is a potent force. If one does not let oneself be oppressed by it, but allows it to live within one as a source of strength, one meets with another experience. These are, of course, mere descriptions, but everyone can have these experiences. In the form of the inner certainty, quote, "This solitude that you are experiencing is of your own making. You have brought it about yourself. It was not born with you. You were born of the God whom you experience. But this solitude was not born with you. It originates from you. You are responsible for this solitude." Close quote. That is the second experience. This experience leads directly to a feeling of shared responsibility for the killing of what has been born of God. At this point, when the solitude of the soul has been exerting an influence for a sufficient time, it becomes clear that something happened at the time when the divine element within man was killed off by the human element. Parenthesis, for this has not always been the case. Otherwise, no evolution would have taken place. There must have been a time when this feeling did not exist. Close parenthesis. If I had time, I would be able to explain more fully what is meant by the killing of the Son of God. Mystical experience should not be something isolated, vague, or indeterminate, but unfolds in stages. It is possible for us to experience the death of Christ. And since this experience has been intensified, then, and I can express it in no other way, the Christ, the risen one, becomes a living presence within us. For the risen one who has, he who passed through death, is initially present as an inner mystical experience. We also experience what motivated his death in the manner described. Thus one can have a threefold mystical experience. But then it is perhaps still not sufficient to find the path to the sources of the mystery of Golgotha. For something else needs to be added, which has been strongly misrepresented today, and even concealed. The only person who has pointed out with a sufficient degree of force what has with the greatest ingenuity been hidden from mankind through 19th-century education and culture was Friedrich Nietzsche, specifically in his treatise titled On the Uses and Abuses of History. For nothing has contributed more thoroughly to obliterating our knowledge of Christ than what passes for history today. And no single factor, therefore, has so thoroughly negated the mystery of Golgotha as the objective historians of the 19th century. Of course, I am well aware that anyone who criticizes these objective historians today is regarded as a fool. And there is no question of belittling the painstaking philological and scholarly efforts that have been devoted to historical research. But however scholarly and exact this history may be, it is a desert for the soul. and history is the surest way to create such a barren wasteland. It has no understanding of the things in human life that really matter. I may perhaps be allowed to speak personally in this realm, for I have certain personal associations in this regard. I have studied Goethe's work since my 18th or 19th year, but I have never felt tempted to write an objective historical account of him or his use of language, for the simple reason that from the very outset the idea that inspired me was that what is most important is that Goethe is alive. The point here is not to focus upon Goethe as a physical human being, who was born in 1749 and died in 1832. What really matters is that since Goethe died in 1832, his spirit has been living on, not only within him as an individuality, but also all around us, in our whole intellectual and cultural environment. And not only in what people say and write about him, and in any case, nothing very illuminating is said about Goethe today. We are indeed surrounded by a spiritual mantle that did not exist for the people of ancient times. The ether body is separated from the soul after death like a kind of second corpse, but through the residual effects of the Christ impulse that have remained from the mystery of Golgotha, it is now conserved to a certain extent and does not completely dissolve. And if we have the faith, I am now using the word in quotes faith in the way that I defined it at the beginning of these lectures, that Goethe has resurrected in terms of his ether body, and on this basis make a study of his work, his ideas and insights will then become alive, and we will not describe him as he was, but as he is now. We will then have brought the idea of the resurrection to life, in such a way that we can believe in it. We can then say that we do not merely believe in dead ideas, but in the living influence of ideas. This is connected with a deep mystery of modern times. No matter what we may think, this is not true of our feeling and will, but what I am saying is true as far as our thinking and perception are concerned, for as long as we are in the physical body, there are impediments to giving full expression to one's ideas in the right way. However great Goethe may have been, his ideas were even greater than he was himself, for his physical body has to bear responsibility for the fact that they were not able to attain a greater stature than they actually did. The moment when they could become separate from the body, and I am now referring to the ideas which in a certain way live on in his ether body, not to his feeling and will, and can be developed further by someone who lovingly embraces them and continues to ponder them, they become something beyond what they were and acquire new life. You need to have faith that the first form in which ideas may arise is on no account the final form that those ideas may have. You need to believe in a resurrection of ideas. Believe so firmly in this that you gladly form a connection not merely with your ancestral blood relations, but with your spiritual ancestors, and that you indeed find them. They do not have to be Goethe's and might well be called Smith or Jones. Fulfill Christ's injunction, not only to relate to bodies through blood, but to connect with souls through the Spirit, and you will then transform the idea of resurrection into a living reality. For what really matters is not to be forever saying, Lord, Lord, but that Christianity can be understood in its living essence, and that its most crucial idea of the resurrection is regarded as a living force. Anyone who, in this sense, derives a certain support from the past is learning to experience the continuing existence of the past. And then it is only a question of time when the moment arrives when Christ is there among you. Everything depends on keeping faith with the risen one and the resurrection and saying, quote, we are surrounded by a spiritual world and the resurrection has become a reality in our midst, close quote. you may well say that this is purely hypothetical. Well, then, let it be an hypothesis. If ever you have to experience the experience of forming a connection with a thought of someone who has died, and whose physical body has been assimilated by the earth, and the thought or idea lives on in you, the time will come when you will say to yourself, quote, "This thought that has become revitalized within me has been made alive by Christ, and it could never have been brought to life in this way before Christ was on the earth." Close quote. There is a path to the mystery of Golgotha which can be followed inwardly. But it really is quite essential to part company with so-called objective history, which, because it dwells only on the outer surface and blots out all reference to the spirit, is actually thoroughly subjective. As you can see, many biographies of Goethe have been written. These biographies of Goethe, by and large, set out to portray his life as faithfully as possible. Every time this is done, something is maimed within the person who is doing it. For the thoughts that Goethe had in the way that he conceived them at the time have passed through death and live on in a different form. It is important that we should understand Christianity in this way, out of a spiritual perception. In short, it is possible to understand the mystery of Golgotha in a mystical way, in the true sense of the word. But one should not remain content with abstractions, but rather undergo the sort of inner experiences that have just been described. And if anyone asks, quote, "How can I myself approach Christ?" close quote, he needs to be aware that he must reach out to the risen Christ, and that, provided that he has the patience and endurance to follow the path that has just been described, he will approach Christ at the right moment and can be sure of meeting him. It is, however, important to be aware of not allowing the most crucial aspects of this encounter to pass one by. I said that Aristotle was in a sense a prophet, and that Julian the Apostate had something of this same prophetic spirit. But because of the form that the Eleusinian mysteries had adopted at that time, he could no longer discover what he sought, and he endeavored to establish a connection with the Mithras mysteries, hence his Persian campaign. He wanted to discover the whole continuity in the mysteries and to understand the connections between them. This could not be allowed, and he was, therefore, assassinated. However, the early church fathers also sought to experience Christ after the fashion of the Eleusinian mysteries. And irrespective of whether we refer to them as Gnostics or not, parenthesis, the real Gnostics were banned from the church, though one could well describe Clement of Alexandria as a Gnostic, close parenthesis, because they endeavored to approach Christ through the Eleusinian mysteries, they related to Christ in a totally different way from their successors. Their relationship with him was such that first and foremost, they acknowledged him as a cosmic being. For example, the question would often be asked, quote, "How does the Logos work purely in the spiritual world?" close quote, and quote, "What were the essential characteristics of that being whom man encountered in paradise? What was this being's connection with the Logos?" close quote. These people concerned themselves with questions of this nature, which have to be answered purely in terms of spiritual conceptions. And the fact is that if one studies the Eleusinian and Mithras mysteries, which were being remorselessly eradicated, in the early centuries after the mystery of Golgotha, the Risen One was himself associated with the mysteries, seeking to reform them. Thus there is a deep truth in the statement that Julian the Apostate was probably a better Christian than Constantine. Constantine was, to begin with, not even initiated, and then his way of accepting Christianity was very superficial. But Julian had an intuitive understanding of the idea that if Christ is to be sought, he can only be found through the mysteries. and that once he has been found, he can endow one with the ego to which human beings could not yet be afforded access at the time of Aristotle. There was, of course, a deep historical necessity involved in the mysteries being so totally eradicated, instead of there being a means whereby the path to Christ could be sought. However, the path to the world of ancient Greece needs to be rediscovered, though without the aid of old records and documents. This world must be revived, though not, of course, as it was. Otherwise, one gets into these absurdities, such as the aping of the Olympic Games. The point is not to mimic ancient Greece, and I certainly do not have that in mind. Ancient Greece needs to be revived from within. And this will surely happen, for people must find the path into the mysteries, albeit in a very inward way. They will, by the same token, also find the Christ. However, just as the first mystery of Golgotha took place in Palestine, so was the second enacted by the impulse brought by Constantine. For the eradicating of the mysteries led to Christ as an historical reality being crucified, killed for a second time. The terrible destruction that spread over several centuries was not merely a destruction of artistic and mystic treasures, though this should not be underestimated, but the destruction of vast swathes of human experience. But there was no understanding of what had actually been destroyed and had disappeared, because any real depth of understanding had been lost. When the temples of Serapis and Zeus were destroyed together with their magnificent sculptures, the people said, quote, "Yes, those who are destroying these temples are right, for ancient legends have predicted that if the temple of Serapis is, or Serapis, readers aside, not sure how to pronounce that, Serapis or Serapis, end of readers aside, is destroyed, the vaults of heaven will collapse, and the earth will be reduced to chaos." But none of this has happened, even though the Roman Christians have leveled the temple of Serapis to the ground. Close quote. It is true that the stars have not fallen in an outward physical way, and the earth has not descended into chaos. But what was formerly known to human experience through sun initiation has disappeared. The whole vast wisdom that in the view of the ancients arced more mightily into the celestial regions than the physical sky fell together with the temple of Serapis. This ancient wisdom of which Julian the Apostate still felt an echo in the Eleusinian mysteries, where the spiritual sun and the spiritual moon hovered over him, raying down their impulses, disappeared without trace. All that the ancients experienced in the Mithras mysteries and in the mysteries of Egypt, where through sacrificial worship they inwardly experienced the mysteries of the moon and the mysteries of the earth as they were manifested within man, when, to use the somewhat banal expression I employed earlier, he arrived at self-knowledge within his inner being through the inner compression of his soul, was reduced to chaos. The spiritual situation was such that the vaults of heaven collapsed and the earth was reduced to chaos. For what disappeared in the course of these centuries was comparable to what would be lost if we were suddenly to be deprived of our senses, when, at any rate for us, the sky would no longer be above us and the earth were no longer to be beneath our feet. The vanishing of the ancient world was not the trifling episode that it is made out to be, but had far-reaching dimensions. If we do not want to accept that what has been lost has disappeared altogether, we need to believe in the resurrection. But this asks of us that the ideas that we formulate should be powerful and courageous, and above all else it is necessary that people today recognize the need for that impulse to which reference has been made so often in these lectures. Human beings have, through a necessary requirement of world karma, although, of course, it is only a necessity from a certain point of view, had to have a sense of having lived for centuries in a somewhat empty and purposeless way. So that out of a strong inner urge for freedom, the Christ impulse can again be found in the fullest sense. However, they must rid themselves of the self-satisfaction in which so many tend to indulge at present. Sometimes this sense of self-satisfaction acquires remarkable dimensions. A Benedictine father by the name of Knauer gave some lectures in Vienna in the 1880s. I should like to read you a passage from these lectures. The lecture from which I should like to read you a short extract is about the Stoics. The most important representatives of the Stoics were Zeno, 342 to 270 BC, clearly, Cleanthes, who lived two centuries before Christ, and Chrysippus, 282 to 209 BC. Thus the members of this school lived several centuries before the mystery of Golgotha. What can an expert on the Stoics tell us about them, bearing in mind that they lived some centuries before the mystery of Golgotha? Quote, "Finally, I should like to say something in praise of the Stoics, in that they had an aspiration toward a league of nations embracing the whole of the human race, which would be potentially able to end all racial hatred and war. I need hardly say that the Stoics were in this respect at a far higher level than the often inhuman prejudices of their time, and even those of later generations." Close quote. A league of nations. I had to read the lecture again, because it occurred to me that I might not have been hearing aright when I heard Wilson and the other statesmen of our present time speaking about a league of nations, because I was hearing the voice of the ancient Stoics from the 3rd century B.C., for they said it much better. They said it much better because they had the power of the ancient mysteries behind them. They said it with an inner power which has now disappeared, and nothing but the empty husk remains. Only those historians who are not historians in the ordinary, somewhat trivial sense see historical phenomena in a different light. And Knauer continues, parenthesis, "I do not need to take back anything that I said about Immanuel Kant. Nevertheless, it is remarkable that a good philosopher like Knauer said the following words about the Stoics in the 1880s, close parenthesis, quote, this idea, close quote, he means the idea of the League of Nations, continue quote, has been revived again and declared feasible by no less a figure among modern philosophers than Immanuel Kant, in his treatise titled On Perpetual Peace, A Philosophical Outline, which is far too little known. Kant's basic idea is, in any event, right and practical. He says that eternal peace must surely arise when the most powerful countries of the world have a constitution that is truly representative." Close quote. Well, this is now referred to, more vaguely, as a reorientation. Kant's term is already pretty innocuous, but now people talk about a reorientation. But in his further study of Kant, Knauer comes up with these additional details. Quote, "Under such a system, the owners of property and the educated classes, who have been most adversely affected by war, will be in a position to take decisions about war and peace. Kant does not, however, consider our constitutions, which are modeled on those of England, to be constitutions that are truly representative. They are mostly dominated by partisanship and sectional interests, which are fostered by an electoral system founded almost entirely on arithmetical and statistical principles. However, the crux of the argument is this, subquote, international law should be based upon a federation of free and independent states, close subquote, close quote. Are we hearing Kant or the voice of reorientation? With Kant, the arguments are more forcefully expressed and more firmly grounded. I do not want to carry on reading what follows, for dear old Kant might otherwise incur the displeasure of the censor. What I have been discussing has been used by a writer whom I have often mentioned, the American author Brooks Adams, as a means of studying the course of human evolution. His aim has been to investigate the significance of the fact that former aspects of human history have, from time to time, been revived by certain peoples, as for example, the way in which the Germanic peoples restored the idea of the Imperium Romanum. As he surveys the present epoch, Brooks Adams finds many similarities with the Imperium Romanum, but nowhere does he find indications of anything that might regenerate it. He does not consider that the Americans can do this. He was writing in America, and there are good reasons for that. For such a revival cannot come from outside. It must come from within, through an enlivening of the spirit. A revival cannot come from bodies. It can only be engendered by souls. However, this is only possible if the Christ impulse is understood in all its living essence. All the stupid, empty phrases that one hears so much of nowadays have to do with the past, but not with the present and future. It is meaningless simply to quote proverbs, such as, quote, Minerva's owl can only spread its wings in the twilight, close quote. This was valid for former times. For when these peoples had reached a certain maturity, they founded schools of philosophy. They looked back in spirit to what they had come to know through instinct. In future, things will be quite different. This instinctive knowledge will not return. Rather, must the spirit itself become instinctive, so that out of the spirit itself the possibility for new creativity can emerge. These are quite momentous thoughts. You need to reflect on these words. New creative possibilities must emerge from the spirit. The power of the spirit must become instinctive. And this all depends on the idea of the resurrection. What has been crucified must arise again. This will not come about through waiting on events. It will only be possible if we make the creative powers of the Spirit truly alive within us. This is what I wanted to say to you at this time on the subject of the mystery of Golgotha. The end of Lecture 15.